We're going to be starting over here with this new packet, which is going to also be up on the Shear Online. So if you're looking for the Shear Online, what it is, I produced a booklet over here, which contains, as we did last time, it has first the psukim, which is going to be the first few pages are going to contain just the psukim. There's places for notes if you're interested. The second section is going to contain sources. So for some of the more major issues on Pshat, I think it would be worthwhile maybe seeing the sources inside, some of the Mefarshim inside. You'll let me know as we go. And hi. Welcome back, Faye.
Thank you.
There we go. And then finally I included what's called two iyunim, two subjects. Rather than sort of doing bits and pieces, I like to leave two major subjects till the end. One is when the story actually occurred, which is relevant, which sheds light actually on what it's doing here. And finally, the intent, what is really going on in the story. So those are two yonim at the end. And finally, you have maps at the end, of course, just to make sure we're geographically I'm in the right place. So without much further ado, let's start at the very beginning. So we have a story which you'll notice is completely disconnected from anything else we've done up till now. When we start the story, this is on page one of the booklets, you'll notice that it just starts with a timeless verse, a timeless pasuk. Vayhi ish mehar Ephraim, there was a man from the mountain of Ephraim, ushmo Michayahu, and his name is Michayahu. We don't know anything else. We're not told when this relates to anybody, when this relates to the previous Shofet. Is this following Shimshon? Is it not following Shimshon? We don't know. So what I'd like to do is leave that question hanging. That's going to be one of the eons at the end, is where this actually belongs in Shoftim, and why it was put here if it didn't actually chronologically occur here. That's something I'd like to leave as a hanging question, because there are going to be many indications which might push and pull in different directions throughout the story. But let me ask you a question. We have a man over here whose name is Michayahu. Michayahu sounds like a very religious name, and he comes from Har Ephraim. Where else? This is for those who are familiar with Shoftim. What else is significant in Sefer Shoftim that occurred at Har Ephraim? Place is not random. What else significant occurred at Har Ephraim? That's a little later. It's in the region, but Har Carmel, a little further north. Who else lived in Har Ephraim? Shiloh's actually nearby, so it's a good point. Shiloh is nearby; it's the neighboring state. But Shimshon, not Shimshon earlier. Philistines were coastal. If you guess them all, you'll definitely. So the point is that we know that Devorah was the Shofetess who lived in Har Ephraim. Devorah lived in Har Ephraim. This is important because wherever you're going to date the story, it's somewhere in the reign of Shoftim, and that means to say that you have in the same mountain range, you have a person who led all of Israel, and you had a person who we're about to see sets up a, we'll call it, a national other side of Avodah Zarah. Yeah, sorry.
It seems it's also significant because Ephraim is from Rachel, and there's always tension between Rachel and Leah. This is before the monarchy split, but not much after this story. We have Shmuel telling Akhababu, but he says, Tovo Lot Ephraim, Tzira Leah, trying to tell people that Ephraim, trying to bolster them about something. So there, it seems, maybe I'm way off, but it seems that it maybe is hinting at some tension.
So there's going to be a tension we have to think about, and you're correct that there is a tension which is going to be important to us, because we're going to have to see at the end how long this lasted. And in fact, in Chazal, we're going to see that Micha himself is associated with people in the northern kingdom later on. So I'd like to hold that thought and think about that in a more global perspective as we get more information historically on this. But just starting off, it is fascinating that we know about a person, we don't know anything about the date. But we do know that he's from a place which should have been a place of religious significance, a place of leadership, and then something else happens there. So we have a personal story. Vayomer le'imo, he says to his mother, Elef u'me'ah ha'kesef asher lukach lach. You know that 1,100 silver pieces that were missing from your cabinet. And you cursed whoever took it. I heard you cursing whoever took that money. I got the money. I'm the thief. Ani lekachtiv as I took it vatomer imo baruch b'ni la Hashem, blessed are you my son to Hashem. So she was very happy that he owns up, and obviously under the duress of the curse. But she is very happy that it owns up. We're talking on a very personal story level. This seems to be a house politics story. However, it continues. Vayoshev es elef umeh hakesef. So he returns this 1100 silver to her. Le'imo. Vatomer imo hekdesh shikdashti es hakesef la'Hashem yadi livni. I have sanctified this kesef to whom? To Hashem. I've sanctified it to Hashem. To do what? La'asos pesel masecha. To make a molten image. A graven or molten image. Va'ato ashivenu loch. And now I'll return it to you. Now that's a bit of a problem. This pasuk is really a bit of a problem.
Why should she donate it to God?
Exactly. Right. God and idols don't usually work in the same sentence. And certainly not in the same person's thought process. Meaning the pasuk may describe them at different points. But here she seems to be thinking that God is going to equal or have this, the Pesal Ma'asecha, which is going to be a big problem. This is going to be one of the problems we're going to have to work through the entire story. Is she trying to serve God? Is she not trying to serve God? Is she deluded? Is she not deluded? That's something we're going to have to think about very carefully over here, because she seems to be very positive. She seems ecstatic at the return of her money, and her response is something which is good but bad and terrible. So that's really what we have to think about carefully over here. That's going to be one of the big points that we have to concentrate on. Vayoshev. So, by the way, just where's the money going? Just to get the flow of money straight. So he returns it to her, right? And what does she say? What she want to do with it? She wants to give it. She wants to give it to the idol. But how is she going to do it? I will restore it to you. Meaning, I'm going to say you're going to be my vehicle of making this idol. That's what's supposed to happen. So let's see how it plays out. In Pasuk Dalet, that's on page 1, Vayoshev es hakesef li'imoy, and he returns the money to his mother. So, you know, it sounds like it's going backwards and forwards, right? Backwards and forwards the money's going. Vatikach imo mosayim hakesef, she took the 200 silver, vatit neyu latzarev, she gives it to the person who fashions it. Vayaseu pesel umasecha, and he makes it into this image, this graven image.
So the son never did make it.
Didn't make it. Va'yibe beis michayon, it was in his house. So what happened over here? It sounds like she's gung-ho about getting him to take the money to make the idol. In the end of the day, he returns it to her, and she makes the idol. So what's going on over here? What's missing between the lines that we don't know? What's the conversation that's missing?
It's also a lot less money now.
And it's a lot less money. Did you notice that? What happened? What happened to the 700, sorry, the 800 change?
No.
Sorry, 900 change?
No.
I was a math major. So what happened to the 900 silver, right? She wanted originally set out for a 1100 silver idol, and now she's only paying 200. So there seems to be some sort of turning point, seems to be some sort of drama in the story which is being told to us via these changes. So already at this point in time, the Mephoroshim jump in, and the Radak on a more simple level just simply says that, you know, he wasn't so excited about this. She was very excited about it. He wasn't excited about it. So he says, you know what, if you want to do it, you do it. So he returns the money to her. That's what seems to be happening. She's got the money. But what about the 200, 1100 discrepancy? She says, well, that's actually just the money that you need to pay the craftsman. Right? Today, when you pay anybody, you pay good money to do the job. We were just in Connecticut in Gillette Castle, which is made by William Gillette. And every single door is made carved out of wood. Now, it cost him in those days $1 million to make the house. But in today's money, that's about $23 million in today's money, it will cost you so much more today because the craftsmanship, welcome back to that. The craftsmanship should be so much more just for the effort that it takes to make things. Right? So over here we have the 1100. So the Radak understands that 900 went to the actual material, 200 went to the actual creating of it. That's the simple way the Radak understands it. But the Malbim takes it a little bit of a twist over here. What really goes on is this is part of his reluctance. He is so reluctant to be involved in this that he says, Mom, don't do this. So she says, you know what, you don't have to do it, I'll do it, and I'll lower the odds. It's not going to be a big idol, just a small one. We'll make a small one. We don't have to make an 1100, we'll make a 200 silver idol, and that's what she makes. That's why the Malbim understands the conversation, that in fact the mother was convinced by the child's by the child's reluctance, which is a very interesting interplay over here within this, because just the discrepancy of the psukim lead us to try to understand what's going on over here.
So they're both a little crazy. Like, first he steals it.
Great.
Then he, like, gives
I mean,
it
yeah, we don't.
And then she's like, yeah, like, well, you know, I don't know, it's supposed to be for Hashem, but actually we're going to use it to make an idol. So
great. So this is it's a fascinating point.
Maybe he knew ahead of time that this is what she intended to.
Maybe that's
why. Maybe she had. We don't hear it in the text, but maybe she had verbalized that she wanted to do something like that. So he took away the money to prohibit it.
To say
possibility.
To say nothing of the fact that he stole from his mother.
Mother, right. So I'd like to, point out.
To
this
prevent
is
her from making an idol to her.
Yeah,
right. So we have to.
Didn't know what she was going to
You're right. There's a lot of problems with these stories, and you have to realize that these stories. There's two stories put at the end of Shoftim. One is called Pesel Mich, which we're dealing with now. The next one is going to be Peleg Shmegiva, and it goes from bad to worse.
Right.
So these stories are not. These stories are not the high points of the nation. And in fact, there's no heroes in these stories. Anybody who seems to be doing something good is going to be tainted. There's something wrong with the way they're doing things throughout all these stories. And perhaps there's a statement being made in these stories about that fact in itself.
But is she equating Hashem with the Pesel Mich?
That's the problem. What is she doing? Is she trying to serve Hashem, right? That's exactly the point that I'd like to come back to with all the psukim at hand to be able to analyze that through
maybe
the Mefarshim.
Maybe she
thinks that serving God is through Pesel Mich. Maybe she's deluded. But that's going to be part of the problem over here. But again, as much as he seems to be reluctant, he seems to be the good guy, he just stole from his mother. So just again, that's again the tension we have. There's no good guys in the story, unfortunately. Okay, and part of I'd like to follow the Malbim's development of character over here, is part of the way the Malbim sees it is we see that although he steals from his mother, he's reluctant to get involved in idolatry. So he pushes it off to his mother, and he even convinces her to lower the stakes. But we're going to have to follow that development of character, because it doesn't seem like he holds that nature, that good nature either.
Thievery is not one of the three cardinal sins.
Right, it certainly isn't. But we seem to see, as you're pointing out, there seems to be some sort of good nature over here that he's expressing. But even that nature is going to waver in just a few moments. Okay, so we have this situation. It's really not something to be praised on in either direction. And now suddenly, Vahish Micha. This is on page one. We're on Pasuk Hey. Vahish Micha Lo Beis Elohim. He has a house of Elohim. Notice how I pronounce that. Right. So this is a house of now in the Machon Mamre they translate it as God with a capital G. But let's go for a moment with Elohim as a non-holy name. So he
Micha
makes
is
himself.
The same as Micha.
Great. Okay. So first, I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. He creates over here a house of God, capital or regular G, Vayas Ephod, and he makes a Ephod, which is this apron, Utrafim, and idols or images, Vayamale es Yad Achad Mibono, Vayhilo Lokohen. And he initiates one of his children to be his priest. Okay, so first thing to notice is, as you pointed out, is that his name's changed. Did you notice that? We started off with a man called Micha Yahu, and now we've met a man called Micha.
Yeah,
so the Malbim,
you meant the Yahu, we've made the graven image.
Well, here we go. That's the problem over here, is that the Malbim, in fact, sees that this is part of the loss. This is part of his of the deterioration to the bottom of the valley. He started off as a person who, we'll call it, only stole from his mother, which is not the way to say things. But he seemed to be, he didn't want to be involved with Avodah Zarah. But suddenly now he has it in his house. In a few minutes, and now suddenly he has priests and he's initiating people. And this whole process is something which is reflected in his name, and from now onwards he's never going to be called Micha Yahu anymore. He's lost that aspect of Hashem's name in his name, and he's only called Micha from now onwards. Okay, so that's part of the development or we'll call it the devolution of this character as the Malbim sees it. And we're going to have to work out, and this is part of the question that we asked before, is this a house of God or is this a house of idol worship? What did he intend when he was making this house? That's going to be part of the question. But we should also realize that, as Leah pointed out beforehand, if you were to just turn to the map, the very, very back of this booklet, which is on page 15, there's the area. Let me just see over here. Yeah, this is the on page 15 we have the first map. So you'll notice that Shiloh is in the right upper section. The right upper section is where Shiloh is. And Har Ephraim is that circling name just round Shiloh. Do you notice that?
Yeah.
So what's disturbing about this is the creation of a base Elohim in the place of base Elohim. Right? Shiloh is the house of the Mishkan at this point in time. And in the same mountain range, in the same area, we're having the creation of what's also called the Space Elohim, or Base Elohim. Okay, and that's part of the problem that we're dealing with right over here. And that might be the comments. Part of the anarchy of these times is the fact that this can exist. And that is the comment, and now we have the comment of the narrator, by Yomim Ahim, in those days, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, there was no king among the Jews, or among Israel. Ish hayashar be'inav yaseh. Each person would do what he saw fit in his eyes. What he saw was straight in his eyes. So what is that saying? Who's the melech who's lacking, who's not here? What does it mean there's no king? What was that?
It's really Hashem, because even when there was a monarchy, it was often corrupt.
Okay, so you're making a good point that monarchy as itself may not be the solution. So we're gonna have to investigate this. But let's take it on a more basic level.
There's no direction.
Great. Okay. So I'm hearing different things. I heard Navi direction and.
There had never been a king.
So just to pull this all together for a moment,
yeah.
It could be. And now Barbanel points out there are two possibilities, which I heard both expressed right over here. There's two possibilities. It could mean there is no king, a king as we know kings, the one who wears the crown, who we're going to see in the next book in Shmuel. So it might be a comment of saying that up till now we have not had a king, and because of that, because there's no firm control, that's why these things can occur. That might be the comment of the narrator. But it could also be that Melech, as the Barbanel understands, is not necessarily a king, but a controller, somebody who gives direction, somebody who may express the word of Hashem at the time. So what's this saying? This is not necessarily a critique on Shoftim. It might be a critique on the fact that there's no leader right now. This incident fell through the cracks. There wasn't anybody to put their foot down. Okay, so there's two directions you can go, and we're going to have to play with both of these, because remember, who's writing Sefer Shoftim is Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel HaNavi was the one who opposed monarchy in Sefer Shmuel. Okay, so he opposed monarchy. He didn't like it, at least in its form and package over there, but he's writing this over here as the narrator. There's no king over here, which seems to be a critique on the fact that there is no king. Okay, so we have to keep these two ideals in
parallel. There's no king. There's no Navi. Up till now, we've had plenty of Navi and plenty of Shoftim who did lead, so it didn't have to be a king.
It didn't have to be. It could be a leader. You're right.
And one of our guys refused the kingdom, you know.
Right, so it could be a leader, as you're saying, but then this would mean to say that this statement is telling us that this story occurred in between them,
right.
Which is going to be helpful in finding out when this was. Yes, sorry, yeah.
It's almost like it's not Ein Melech, but Ein Malach. Like there's a missing he there. Like Hashem is
That's
missing.
Part of it.
But also, Shmuel only lived 52 years. So
okay.
almost everything he wrote here, he either got from Nebuah, or he didn't witness most of what he writes about.
Correct, so he didn't. But he, as relating all the, we'll call historical documents or tradition, is giving a commentary on that tradition because he's spinning it in a particular direction. Once we have the full book as a whole, it might be worthwhile actually going back and seeing how Shoftim as a whole comments on monarchy. Okay, because Shoftim doesn't give one message about him. Even this very story is going to give different messages. At this point in time, it sounds like king good, Shoftim bad, or leader good, lack of leader bad. That's what it sounds like. But that's not going to be the message we're going to get through the entire story. That sounds good. Right.
Yeah.
So Shoftim is going to present a complex message, as will the story. At this point in time, it sounds like it's one-directional. Fine. So that's section one. We have the establishment of the house of this person called Micha, at this point called Micha. And now we have our second character. Our second character is, in the bottom of page one, Vayihi Na'ar, there's a lad, Mibeis Lechem Yehuda, from the place of from Bethlehem, Mimishpachas Yehuda, from the family of Yehuda, Vuhu Levi, and he's a Levi, Vuhu Garsham, and he dwelt there. It's a bit of a complicated sentence, don't you think? Right, so we know about his place, we know two places. We know about Bethlehem, and he lives there, but at the same time, where is his family from exactly? It's from Yehuda and Levi, it sounds like, right? He's from the family of Yehuda, but he's a Levi. So that's a bit of a...
Levi lived everywhere.
Levi did live everywhere. So one possibility is he could have been an Ir Levium, one of the Arei Levium in Yehuda, which is a perfectly acceptable idea, that it could have been one of the cities of the Levites, which is actually the Mepharshim deal with
in
Yehuda.
But he doesn't have a name.
But he doesn't have a name, but he does have a name. That's the problem, you see. This is part of something we have to think about in the story, is he actually does have a name, but anticlimactically, we only told at the end of the story. So you'll just turn to page 7 for a moment. The technique of the story as well is also showing us something. The 7, this is the very end. This is the second last pasuk of the whole incident. It says in pasuk Lamed, Vayakim Elohim b'nei Dan es ha-pesel. So b'nei Dan, we're going to see, are going to adopt or kidnap this pesel. V'yonasan b'en Gershon b'en Menashe, hu bonov, hu yukonim l'shevet adoni. And this person called Yonasan, son of Gershon, son of Menashe, and his children were the priests for the Shevet Adoni ad yom gelos haaretz, until the day that the land was exiled. And the assumption is that this is the same person, this is the Nair that we're talking about over here, this young lad, who was originally the priest. And
he was a Ben Levi.
Great. So you see, once you put the name into the mix, then it gets even worse. Because we, on the one hand, we're told about Yehuda, Levi, and now we have a person who's the grandson of Menashe. And if we're taking Menashe as a tribe, then we have three tribes. But it could just be a person called Menashe. So that's a bit of the problem of who this character is. And when you see complex descriptions, it obviously relates to complex characters. And that's part of what the problem is with this gentleman over here. And you'll notice that, by the way, just for argument's sake, who is Gershom? Who else do we know is Gershom in the Torah?
Moshe's son.
Okay, so interesting point, just something worthwhile thinking about, is that although we have the wonderful text of the Machon Mamre in our printing over here, is if you were to actually look in Tanakh itself, that nun in Menashe is not a nun which is on the line. It is called a nun tluya. It is halfway, it is hanging. Right? So just if you just read it without that nun for a second, you have Yonasan ben Gershon ben Moshe. Okay, so there's this nun which is hanging there. We don't know why yet, but there's and somehow it seems to relate to him as being the grandson of Moshe, if that'd be the reading of that, which is very unusual. But that does save us because he's from Levi, right? Because Moshe was a Levite. Right, okay, yeah.
I had read somewhere, somebody went to visit a man in Israel during the time of Joshua, and he was sort of somewhat heathen or whatever. He said he was the son of Moshe, and he had kind of fallen off the derrick. He was not born.
It could be this. It could be exactly this. So jumping exactly to that point, if you're to turn to page 9, the Gemara and Chazal address this particular point of who this person is, and this relates to what you're just saying, is that the Gemara is really perturbed about this entire incident. The very bottom page 9 in the box is the Gemara in Bava Basra on page Kuf Tesomabez. I brought the translation as well over there. It's on both sides. So the bottom page 9 in Shoftim Yuzayin, which is what we just discussed. Vayhi Na'ar mi Beis Lechem Yehuda. We have a lad from Bethlehem. Mishpachas Yehuda v'hu Levi. He's from the family of Yehuda and is a Levite. V'hu Gar Shom. He dwells there. Haguf Akasha. There's an intrinsic error. There's an inherent contradiction. Omar Tvahu Levi, you said that he is a Levite. Alma mi Levi Osi. That seems to imply that he comes from Levi. Mi Mishpachas Yehuda. But you also tell me that he comes from the family of Yehuda. Alma mi Yehuda Osi. It sounds like he's coming from Yehuda. So make up your mind. Where does he come from? Elo Lav. Rather, it must be Davu mi Levi v'ime mi Yehuda. It might have been that, in fact, it was a mixed marriage. Maybe his father was from Levi and his mother's from Yehuda. But you should remember, mixed marriage is not so simple. Remember, we saw in the Yiftach incident that his mother was called a Zona, according to some of the Farshim, because she married out of tribe, even though there wasn't a prohibition on that. Right. So just interesting to put that in there. But nobody's going to comment on that right now. Yes, sir, yeah.
I heard from Gora's future son-in-law that Rashi's, he was sent from David HaMelech. He had four daughters, and he wanted to keep the Yehuda line. He made sure all his four daughters
married Yehudas. There you go. Fascinating. There are people who can still draw their way back. I know people who actually can draw their lineage back too. Oh, well, there you go. Family tree next time. So we have this person. It may have been that it's been described because of his mother's and his father's lineage, which maybe is not necessarily so relevant to the story. However, but it says from the family Yehuda, I apologize. But it sounds like he says he's from the family of Yehuda. Omar Rava bar Rav Chanan. Rather, it must be, says Rava bar Rav Chanan, Loi Gavro Dishmei Levi. Maybe his name was actually Levi. Right, so maybe his name is Levi, and he comes from Yehuda. We have many, many Levis, particularly in certain circles, who are not Leviim. It just that happens to be their name. Ihachi, hainu tekaamar Micha. So that makes sense that Micha says later on, Atoyodati ki yetiva Hashem li, ki hayo li Levi ha-Levi le-Kohen. We're going to see in a moment that Micha is going to be very excited that this person is going to join his forces because he is a Levite. He won't be excited because his name is Levi. It doesn't make a difference what his name is if he's going to be his priest. The point is where he came from. If he is a Levi, that's what's making him happy. So the answer is in. Isrami le gavra dishmei Levi. Really, he had a person. He was happy that he found a person whose name was Levi, which seems a little unlikely. V'chi Levi shmoi, is his name really Levi? V'alo Yonasan shmoi. We know that his name is Yonasan. You see, Chazal's working through this piece by piece. You notice each stage we're bringing in later pieces of the story. And finally, we know his name is Yonasan. Shenemar, as it says in the pasuk we just quoted, V'yonasan ben Gershon ben Menashe hu uvanav hayukanim l'shevet Adani. We know that he and his children were these priests, and his name was Yonasan. Omar Le, the response is Velitameich v'chi ben Menashe hu. But if you're going to tell me that his name is Yonasan, but then how can he come from Menashe? V'alom ben Moshe hu. Gershom is the son of Moshe. Dichsiv, as we see in Divrei Yamin, B'nei Moshe Gershom v'Eliezer. The sons of Moshe are Gershom and Eliezer. Elo. Now this is the punchline. We're finally getting to the punchline after the to and fro. Mitoich she'osa ma'ase Menashe. Because this person acted like Menashe, Tala'o ha'kosuv b'Menashe. The pasuk depended him, or we'll say aligned him with Menashe. Hachonami mitoich she'osa ma'ase Menashe da'osim Yehuda tala'o ha'kosuv b'Yehuda. Again, which tribe did Menashe the king come from? He came from the tribe of Yehuda. So in a certain sense, we have this person. Let's just iron out the details of here, because we've gone through a bit of a conversation. This person, says the Gemara in its conclusion, is a person from the tribe of Levi. His name, as the Tanakh tells us, is Yonasan. Who is he? He's the son of Gershon. Who is Gershon? The son of Moshe. That's who he is. However, he has a few appellations. We get the Tanakh is going to describe him in a certain manner to try to bring out something about his character. One thing it's adding is that when saying he's the son of Moshe, it doesn't say Moshe specifically, it says Moshe with a nun hanging there. So we should know he's really from Moshe, but he has what's called he has the sway. He could be also from Menashe. What did Menashe do? What was Menashe the king's what was that? So Menashe did many terrible things, and in Melachim it spares no words to tell you how terrible he was. And one of the things he did, as Leah says, was he brought idolatry back into Israel. So great was his perversion that it says that the Beis Hamikdash was signed to be destroyed from that time, and could not be retracted. That's how great the sin of Menashe was. So in a certain sense, we have a person over here who's going to be acting as a priest. He's going to be acting as a priest for Avodah Zarah. He's effectively doing the same thing as Menashe himself. And where did Menashe come from? He came from the tribe of Yehuda. So Tanakh is sort of adding in these extra details to give us a character alignment. To say that when we think of this person, we think of Moshe, but there's also in the background there's the shadow of Menashe from Yehuda, who's being superimposed onto this character. But also notice that nun isn't there definitely. It's hanging. So at this point in time, it still could go either way. Because we don't know the end of his story. There's something interesting actually happens at the end of his life. Yes?
It quotes Divrei HaYamim in the source.
I was wondering about that.
Divrei HaYamim records the story of Menashe. It does mention that he did do tshuva when he was put into the bag.
Right, so Menashe did do tshuva, which is going to be something we're going to think, because this Yonasan person does reappear later on, and that might be another aspect of Menashe. Menashe had a tshuva. Great question. It does.
Exactly, Menashe doesn't mention it.
It's a great. Well, the Divrei HaYamim mentions it. Menachem doesn't. So it's the whole description of Menashe and his tshuva and how he was answered and why it's in one place and not another is really an incredibly interesting topic, as you said, because it does sound very coerced.
Did Shmuel live into the reign of Menashe?
Ah, fantastic. Did Shmuel live in the reign of Menashe? So this is we're gonna encounter a few psukim over here that are going to be not beyond the time of this of Shmuel and Navi. One of them is if you're going to understand this is cross referencing Menashe in the future, then you're going to have to deal with this. Another one is going to be a little later on about talking about future exiles, which are not in the span of Shmuel's life. So when you deal with things like this, we're going to have to, as we will then, either work with the premise that he's receiving this as a nevuah, or that a later Navi added in that point, at that specific point. Meaning maybe Yirmiyahu, who has the perspective, can say, he gives a gloss, which is what something like Barbanel would say in some certain situations. Fine, fantastic. Great, so we're on the path, we meet this anonymous, or up till now, anonymous person who's being conveyed to us, his character's being conveyed to us with certain associations. And he comes walking along the road, and he arrives at where? At this person's house. Vayelech ha'ish meha'ir, and the person and the man walks from the city. Mibeis lechem Yehuda lagur ba'asher yimtzah. He's gonna dwell wherever he finds. He's got his backpack on his shoulder. This is, wherever he finds a good place is gonna be good. Vayovo har Ephraim, and he comes to the mount of Ephraim. Ad beis michal asas darkon. He comes to the house of Ephraim. This is part of his journey. Interesting point. What is he looking for? So Rashi points out that he's looking for, what is he looking for? He's going to go and dwell any place he finds. He finds what? He finds work. Rashi points out he's looking for parnasa.
One pasuk to go, I'm sorry.
Yes.
He was a nar and now he's an ish.
Yeah, okay. So we're going to see in actually this person.
Maybe he was a nar.
I didn't speak Yiddish in those days. And it is.
We could all write a pirush from there. it's a good point that you're noticing this. You'll notice that actually, if we follow these psukim, there's going to be four descriptions. Okay? Binyamin is described as a nar earlier on, even though he was a 40-year-old as well. So nar might not be a reflection of age, which is something to think about.
But
Yeshua's nar lo yamish mitarcha oil. So there's another people called nar. Nar might be a description of a certain type of vigor or youngness at heart, at least. But I think it's a good point to notice that his description again is going to change, not just between nar and ish. It's going to change two times again. And then in the future psukim. So something is being conveyed by the change of his description. So follow that through as well. That's a very good point to notice. What we do need to make note of is that, as Rashi points out, that he is looking as well for parnasa. This is going to be a central theme to this character. He is always looking for parnasa. Okay? We're going to follow that through as well. He is always looking for parnasa. Vayomer lo micha me'ayin tavo. So Micha says, where are you coming from? Vayomer elav Levi anochi. I am a Levi. That doesn't mean it's his name, as you saw the conclusion of the Gemara. I am a Levite. Mibeis lechem Yehuda. I'm coming from Yehuda, which might be in the city or the nearby where he's dwelling, as Timna pointed out, it may have been one of the cities of Leviim, which was nearby there. Vanochi holech lagur ba'asher emtzah. I'm going to sojourn in the place that I find. Vayomer lo micha shvoi modi. Micha says, you know what? Stay with me. Veheye li la'av ula kohen. You shall be to me as, he has another two descriptions. You'll be a father and a kohen. This is a bit of a dramatic irony in a certain sense. We're being told he's a nar, and we're being told to psukim later that, you know what, don't worry, you'll be the leader. You'll be the father and the priest. That's a bit of a dramatic irony within the description over here. Again, you see this, the switch of his description.
Two mishpatim, two psukim earlier, he was an ish, not a nar.
Yeah, but then earlier he was a nar. So he was a nar, ish, and an av. So what is he? That's the question. Where is he being described? You're pointing out, you're tempering it, saying there has been a development over here.
Yeah.
A point well taken.
Right.
V'anochi yeten lecho aseres kesef liyamim. I'm going to give you 10 silver for a Yamim is a period of time which we have seen before measures to a year. Ve'erech begodim u'michiyasechos. I'm going to pay your house and board. Vayelech ha'levi. And the Levi agreed. This walking is, he agreed to walk in these ways. He acquiesced. So again, just part of the anarchy of this time is like, you know, just a random person walks into your house and suddenly he becomes he's going to suddenly be the av and the kohen. The lack of guidance, the lack of from top down kind of leadership is also just being framed in this, even in this, at this point in time, family house of worship. is there's a bit of a problem in this in the leadership. And finally, Vayoel HaLevi LaSheves, and this Levite was they describe over here is content to dwell. That's the way they describe it in Mechon Mamre. Or could be he began to dwell. LaSheves es ha'ish to stay with Micha Vayianar lo ka'achas mibonav. He was one of his boy, his sons. So again, remember, he's being called an Av, but he's one of the children. Okay, just again, this is again the leadership. The who's leading this household is not 100% clear. Sorry. Yeah. So on the simple pshat, it just means to say that he treats him like one of his own. Right. That's a point we'll take.
Maybe he meant to call him Nar again.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So
maybe he was referring to his naivete.
He
could see him as someone who could be easily manipulated.
Right. So Nar might be referring to that aspect of him, and in fact, he is a very easily manipulated person. Anybody who lays an offer on the table, you'll see that suddenly he turns around, depending how big it is. So that's what we're going to have to watch the development of this character, is that might be the aspect of Na'arus, which we see in him.
It was a problem with the Levim. I think a lot of
the
Levim were wandering around looking for
money
to earn
living. I don't know enough to know that, but it is possible. They weren't employed. They had their employment in Shiloh, but to the extent of the operation of Shiloh and the Mishkan would be the extent of the success. So that might be a comment on the success of the VM operating generally as well, but I don't know historically enough yet about this. Although the Torah does warn us to make sure to look after people who are of lesser, we'll call it financial status, and one of them is the VM when it comes to your gates. I just want to finish this particular section before a comment. And Vayamale Micha es Yad HaLevi, so Micha initiated this Levi, Vayihilo Lehanar Lekoyen, and he made him into his priest, and he stayed in the house of Micha. And Micha responded, Ato Yodati, now I know, Kiyetiv Hashem Li, God will be good to me, Kihoyoli HaLevi LeKohen, because this Levite is going to be my Kohen, which is interesting. So obviously he's happy that he gets somebody from the tribe of Levi, because even though he's not a Kohen, Levi was not Kohen, Levi was the greater category from which Kohanim were a subsection, but at least he's got a pseudo Kohen. So meaning to say, I'm going to have more believability in when it comes to other people. And the last comment I'd like to make just before we close of it today is this Lashon of Vayoel HaLevi. I find this personally very interesting, just because this, remembering that he is the grandson of Moshe, if you had to take a quick look on page 9, the very top of the page, there's actually a very similar statement made about Moshe, and I just want to follow this word through for a second. Is in Parshas Shmos, where Moshe is exiled from Egypt, it says Vayoel Moshe Lasheves Es HaIsh. Very interesting parallel, right? Do you see? It's almost the same sentence. Moshe began to say or start saying at the man. Who's the man, by the way? The man is Yisro, right? Vayitan es Tzipora b'Tola Moshe, and he married off his daughter to him. Vatelet ben vatikra shmo Gershon. And the next pasuk is the birth of Gershon, who is the father of this person, which is just interesting to me, this parallel over here. Ki omar gero yisiber etz nochri. And I'd like to explore Gershon as a character a little later on, maybe as a continuation here. But I just do find it interesting that Shoftim is framing this in the same way that Moshe. Let's just recap the stories. Moshe is wandering. Moshe is looking for a place to go. He's in exile, and he finds a place that takes him in. But when he's taken in, it's described as Vayoel Moshe. We also have his grandson, the person who's described in the next passage, also wandering around, taken in. But it's much more of a negative connotation over here, because here it's not for positive. There's nothing positive about this dwelling. But clearly, we're being taken back centuries to remind us, not centuries, but decades, to remind us where he comes from and what's going wrong in this description.
So Vayoel only to mean agreed or began?